Hello, everyone. This is Mary Sutherland, BUFO Radio, and I want to welcome you to the show. Tonight we have with us Don Schmidt, the leading expert on Roswell. Hi, Don. How you doing?
Hi, Mary. So nice to be back with you.
Oh, it's always good to have you on. You got a new book out, huh? A second edition to the last book that you did, Witness to Roswell.
The best-selling Witness to Roswell.
Best-selling,
and
huh?
We went back to our editor, and after demonstrating that we had put together about 50 new witnesses and a number of new potential chapters, and they took it to his board, and they enthusiastically agreed to re-release it as a revised, updated new edition with 4 new chapters, 100 more pages, and we've filled it out with, as I said, 50 new eyewitness accounts. So the chase continues, the race with the Undertaker, so to speak.
I don't want to give away your book, entire book, but we do have an hour to do for a show, so I guess I'm going to have to ask you some questions
please,
on this.
Please, whatever you'd like.
So what, these new witnesses, what did they have to say?
One of the things we focused on in an entirely new chapter, and just to give your audience a little background, and certainly Roswell has become a household word around the world. I don't think there's a country that just by the mention of the word, the very connotation of whether it be a UFO crash, but even so much as the word cover-up, because it has become synonymous. In fact, even movies, it's an ongoing theme that you mentioned cover-up, you think of Kennedy assassination, and you think of Roswell. The two seem somehow to be forever linked, and I'll allow other researchers to delve into the possible connection. But nonetheless, as far as I'm concerned, we're talking about the granddaddy of all UFO cases and potentially the granddaddy of all cover-ups, because something crashed in the high desert of New Mexico, about 35 miles north of Roswell, and at that time in 47, was the headquarters of the first atomic strike force in the world. This was the particular squadron, the 509th Bomb Group, which had dropped the very first atomic bomb on Japan, and then the subsequent one, which would then end World War II. And we're talking the elite within the United States military at that time. The best pilots, the best crewmen, the best officers, the best doctors, the best nurses. And they all happened to be part of that one unit. And ironically, they were at Roswell at the time of this incident. So they were in charge of the recovery, the retrieval, the containment, and basically the cover-up in that regard. And they put out a press release where they actually announced, they acknowledged that they had indeed captured a flying saucer. And that came out on July 8th of 1947. Unfortunately, 5 hours later, they retracted it, they reversed that position and claimed it was nothing more than a weather balloon. And that explanation would stand for the next 30 years until Major Jesse Marcel, head of the intelligence group at Roswell, broke his security oath. He was dying of emphysema at the time, and actually claimed that it wasn't the weather balloon. I mean, he stated in no less words that being familiar with all domestic and foreign materials, but this was something else. And as he put it, this was something not manufactured on this earth. And I know you're having Jesse Marcel Jr., Dr. Marcel.
Right.
At the Burlington Vortex, and his son, Jess Jr., was a first-hand witness to the material, as you certainly know.
Right.
And will certainly go into great detail at the conference as to what he actually handled, what he observed, what impressions, what memories he has after now 62 years of what transpired as his father woke his mother and him, took them to the kitchen, and there he had the material, actually some of it scattered on the kitchen table and kitchen floor. And so your audience is in for a real treat in that regard at the conference.
And he really wasn't that young when this happened, if I remember right. Well, I did a show with Jesse, and
yes.
And I believe that Jesse said that he was 10 years old. So, I mean, his memory was there. I mean,
of course.
I mean, he remembered everything.
Well, it's no different than whenever the scoffers, the debunkers, they're not skeptics, because skeptics, I was a skeptic when I first worked on Roswell as an independent investigation starting back in the fall of 1988. And we made our first trip in February of 1989. A skeptic is objective, open-minded, willing to allow the evidence to take he or her wherever it happens to go. And unlike the scoffers, the debunkers, who just, you know, there's no evidence that's ever going to convince them otherwise. They have their minds made up. And the situation, as far as with Dr. Marcel, and originating even with his father, the argument that I often make as these scoffers suggest that, well, as you get older, your memory fails, and you tend to confabulate and, you know, even fabricate the information because you fill in the gaps, and the military, the government even uses the term of time compression, that you start to even mix the decades, let alone the years. Now, you mentioned Jesse being 10 years old at the time, and he certainly had full memory and cognizance and lucidity as far as what he was observing. He had an understanding already, being the son of a military officer who very often drew sketches for him, showed him what they were working on, what they were testing, what they were doing. And so, as an only child, Jesse Jr. had a rare opportunity that he became also the best friend to his father. In that regard, he became a confidant, and which enabled him to take in experiences such as actually handling the pieces of some of the wreckage that was recovered on the part of his father. And I always cite, I mentioned earlier, the JFK assassination. Now, you mentioned Jesse being 10 years old. Well, at the time of the Kennedy assassination, I was 9. And I will, for the rest of my life, remember exactly where I was, what I was doing, the announcement, the mood, as far as the classroom, the teachers, spending that entire weekend. You know, my father was away on business. I can describe exactly what transpired and how we still went to a scheduled Cub Scout event that weekend and so on. And the point is, I wasn't there. I wasn't involved. I wasn't down in Dallas. I wasn't in Dealey Plaza. I didn't see anything firsthand. Yet I will remember for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And what an insult to anyone's intelligence to suggest that the likes of Jesse Jr., because he was 10 years old and because it was 62 years ago, that, well, you know, his memory has failed him. He doesn't know what he handled. That's nonsense. That's nonsense. Because whenever the skeptics come up with a 90-year-old witness to the contrary, they trot them right out. And, well, as long as they sing their tune, they're happy to have, you know, their endorsement as far as their non-secular explanations for so many things.
And Jesse went on to be followed in his father's footsteps in the military, and went on to be a colonel.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, and as a colonel, he still spoke of it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, it wasn't just all of a sudden in his latter years that he spoke of his father and what transpired during that night.
I don't know if Jesse brought this up, because it's a rather somber note, and we should have anticipated what might transpire. But with a film crew from the NBC Today Show in 1990, we attempted hypnotic regression with Jesse Jr. to take him back to that very night and relive it firsthand.
Yeah.
What transpired, what his father was saying, what his mother was saying, what the actual conversation, what words were being, you know, actually said at the time. And we enlisted the assistance of Dr. John Watkins, who was Professor Emeritus from the University of Montana at Missoula. And he was the doctor who got the Hillside Strangler to confess under hypnosis. So he came highly qualified to work with us. And there was a professional resistance between the two, doctor against doctor. Nothing happened through the morning, nothing happened through the afternoon, and then late in the afternoon, he finally managed to get Jesse into a deep enough trance by first describing specific incidents that even happened leading up to the Roswell incident. And he talked about how his dog died. He talked about, and as an example of just how good a young boy Jesse Jr. was and how loyal and respectful he was of his father. He described how he took his bike to pick up a pie for his dad one time. And on his way home, he tipped his bike. And even though he injured himself, he was more concerned that he had wrecked the pie and that he would disappoint his dad. And it said, it spoke volumes. It said so much about the character of the man. And then when he actually talked about how his father would bring him into the kitchen from a sound sleep at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and how his father said over and over again, wreckage of a flying saucer, pieces of a flying saucer crash. Not once did he imply or suggest in any way that it was a balloon, an airplane, a rocket, anything. He kept using that term, flying saucer, over and over again. And we even had him sketch the symbology that he observed and handled on the I-beam structures that he'll be describing at the Vortex conference. And what we did not anticipate, as I was leading up to, his father had just died 4 years before, in 1986, of emphysema. And when Dr. Watkins brought him out of the regression and he looked around the room and he went, Dad, looked to the other side, he went, Dad, and then the tears started to stream down his face. And it was like, oh my God, it was so real to him. We didn't realize he had just lost his father all over again, and we put him through that.
Wow.
And he swore to us he would never undergo hypnosis again. But every word he said, and even Dr. Watkins, he described everything that he had before, everything that his father had before he passed away, everything that his mother had also confided to us. So I don't understand why there should remain any doubt. It's no difference than when the Air Force came out with the third official explanation, which they labeled a new theory, and that's the word they used over and over again in the Project Mogul explanation, new theory. And Jesse would talk about how Captain James McAndrew, who was one of the authors and the researchers of that 700-page report, would call him persistently over and over again, what is it going to take to make you believe that it was a piece of masking tape that you saw with flowers painted on it? That's all it was. What's it going to take for you to back off of this flying saucer nonsense? And in the last conversation, after a half a dozen attempts at McAndrew trying to, you mean forcefully, you know, get Jesse Marcel to change his tune, Jesse finally told him, I don't care what the Air Force says, I don't care what they've told you to say it was, I know what I held in my hands, I saw it. You didn't. I was there. You weren't. So what do you have to say to that? And Captain McAndrew would say, and this is something that only came out within the last year, because Jesse was keeping this pretty much to himself, that finally McAndrew recanted and said, well, I guess we'll never know what you actually saw. And that was quite an admission, quite a concession, that they were leaving the door open. So in other words, I can't beat you. I can't make you change your story. But that's the point of all the Roswell witnesses, even to their deathbeds, for all of the threats, for all of the intimidation, all the harassment to not only themselves but their families, that even up to now 62 years, we're batting 100% as far as the witnesses. The government is batting zero.
Yeah. It, you've actually interviewed witnesses that saw the alien bodies as well, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In fact, when the Project Mogul report came out, we kind of went after the New York Times because, once again, they were quick to make it a front-page banner headline. And we expressed, you know, that very point, that we had first-hand witnesses to the bodies. And how indeed would a weather balloon, even a top-secret project balloon, which Mogul was, the components weren't top-secret. It was merely the same type of balloon, but just that it was part of a top-secret project. It was still neoprene rubber and a radar kite, reflective kite of foil, wooden sticks, masking tape, and twine. And it had an acoustic listing device. And the theory was that if the Soviets were detonating their own atomic bombs, we would pick up a shock wave from the upper atmosphere. Well, anyway, the Times finally agreed that if we could provide a single first-hand witness to the bodies, and it would check out, not only would they recant the Mogul balloon, retract the balloon explanation, they would also retract the 1947 weather balloon explanation as well. Well, we couldn't, you know, leave it uncalled, and we didn't provide them with a single witness. We provided them with eight. They wanted one, we gave them eight. And you think they ever got back to us? No.
No.
Again, they had no intention. But it again demonstrates that whenever we call the press on the record to actually look at the physical evidence, look at the eyewitness testimony, look at the circumstantial eyewitness information, look at the documentation, they turn the other way. Last fall, I was at the very hangar in Roswell. It was P3 in 1947. It's now Building 84. It's a B-29 hangar. In fact, the Enola Gay, which had dropped the first atomic bomb in Hiroshima, as well as the boxcar, which had dropped the second bomb on Nagasaki, were both hangared at this particular building in 1946. And this is where the wreckage and the actual remains of the ship and the bodies were stored and were transited until they were shipped out. And I was there with a CNN science reporter, Miles O'Brien, and at one point he finally asked me, he said, now Don, you've devoted 20 years of your life to this. You spent all this time. Why are you doing this? And I looked him square in the eyes and I said, because you won't. And I struck a raw nerve because he didn't have an answer to that. And it's the same thing I would say to any reporter, because you won't. I think it's as simple as this, Mary, that if there's any chance that this is true, any chance that the United States government is sitting on physical proof that we're not alone, that we have been visited, that they have had the proof for now over 60 years. We're talking about the biggest story of the millennium. And whoever gave them full authority to withhold such, you know, a momentous, you know, announcement from the world.
Well, you know, the strange thing is we've actually had presidents that have come forward, you know, and said, yes, there are such things as UFOs. Jimmy Carter even gave a UFO report on it.
When he was governor of Georgia, correct.
So, you know, who are these people that they have so much power that they their voice supersedes the presidents of the United States of America?
It's a frightening proposition when you consider it.
I think one of the things is, Don, is that people, they don't want to, somehow they're in such denial that even though a president of the United States says, yes, you know, I've actually saw a UFO, they'll go to news media, you know, that are pumping out disinformation and quickly jump onto that so that they don't have to, you know, they don't have to, you know, they're too comfortable in their comfort zone.
Well,
you know,
I've never expected any politician, as far as local or certainly on a national level, to take this subject seriously, because they're in a perpetual campaign mode. There are two things that, you know, any politician are ever concerned with. And it's getting reelected, and it's staying in office.
But we've had the governor of New Mexico come forward on it.
Well, and that was at our encouragement. And he wrote the foreword to one of our books, Governor Bill Richardson. And much to, you know, our approval, he, on numerous occasions when he's been asked on both, you know, TV and radio about the subject, and he has expressed and lamented the same concern. He mentioned Jimmy Carter. Bill Clinton has been in the same boat. And even while
Kennedy?
President.
Kennedy?
We know that Kennedy even appointed Johnson, and I have it from a very high-ranking source, now deceased, but nonetheless, he was a naval flight surgeon by the name of Dr. Peter Rank. And he was aware of the fact that Kennedy had appointed his VP, Lyndon Johnson, to a special UFO oversight committee. His brother, Bobby, was a card-carrying member of one of the civilian UFO groups around that time. So I think one thing one has to remember is that John F. Kennedy was in Navy intelligence after World War II. So he indeed may have had access. Dwight Eisenhower was chief of staff for the Army back in 1947, so he certainly would have had access. Problem is, as Eisenhower even, you know, would complain in his own memoirs, that even as a five-star general, that after he, you know, was sitting in the Oval Office, the Pentagon didn't tell him anything any longer. And I think that's also for a reason. I think it's intended to also protect the president. If you burden the president with all the deep, dark secrets that we're withholding from our enemies, he becomes the sole target.
Yeah.
You kidnap the president, you know, you have the whole store, so to speak. And as we know, the military is very compartmentalized. Need to know. And I'm sure they place the president, even albeit commander-in-chief, in that same.
Right.
That same situation.
And then besides that, they look at, they may be only in office 4 years, at
precisely,
most 8 years, and then
walking,
what happens? And
they're walking the street.
Mm-hmm.
They're walking the street.
They
don't tell the president anything more than they need to.
Yeah. But now, when you were interviewing these witnesses that saw the alien bodies, did the descriptions, did they match the... Or tell us about that. Did they all seem to be pretty much in agreement what they look like?
Yes, totally. In fact,
because it seems like, you know, if they were all in agreement about what they look like, and if they hadn't spoken among themselves, that would be a pretty good indicator, you know, that of them telling the truth.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Mary. In fact, it's one of the reasons that if, and I know you and Brad have been to the museum in Roswell.
Several times.
And throughout the museum, there is not an accurate depiction of the bodies anywhere. We've made sure of that.
Yeah.
It's the same thing that when we did the Roswell movie with Showtime back in 1994, which was based on our first book, UFO Crash at Roswell. That when we worked with Steve Johnson, with FX, as far as in designing the surviving alien, and as well as the cadavers, that it was not as the witnesses have described. Anybody comes along and describes that movie alien, we know they're not telling the truth.
And so far, you haven't really come forward yet, have you, and described what has been told to you, what they look like, just for that reason?
In general terms, and we've yet to actually, we have numerous sketches from eyewitnesses. We've had, you know, a dozen descriptions through the years. And much to the credit of these witnesses, they don't talk about spacemen. They don't call them ETs, extraterrestrial aliens. They talk about the little men. They talk about the little bodies.
Uh-huh.
They talk about the little people. They talk about the child-sized bodies and how they were even the size of children, except that their heads were disproportionately larger. And the staring eyes, the larger eyes, they generally have all described as far as the silver one-piece jumpsuit, you know, coverall. But we just had another witness a few weeks ago talk about how the one out at the crash site appeared so serene, so peaceful, as though it was lying in repose. And when he first was brought to the site as a doctor, he was shocked because at first he thought they were children because from a distance they were so small. And then as he came directly to the area, and yeah, obviously the shock even intensified because he realized they weren't human. So as one of the officers one time commented when he was asked, he said, well, they sure weren't from Texas.
Yeah. Or New Mexico.
Or New Mexico, right.
How many bodies did they find?
Well, to be quite honest, there were two body sites. You have
multiple
sites because we have the debris field, which is about 65 miles to the northwest. This is where even Major Marcel, Jesse Jr.'s father, the head of intelligence, had initially concluded that there had to have been a mid-air explosion, mid-air mishap, that it was either struck by lightning or an internal malfunction, and for some reason the object exploded, raining material down through that particular pasture, almost 3/4 mile long, a few hundred feet wide, and there was a pod, like an escape capsule of sorts, the flight cabin, that then continued on for another 30 miles before impacting about 35 miles north of town, north of Roswell. And along the way, a number of the bodies were either, you know, sucked out by the decompression or by the percussion of the explosion itself. And they would be discovered just a few miles from the debris field. Now, there were a couple bodies there, and at the impact site, as we call it, much closer to Roswell, there were three bodies there, plus one survivor. And we also have two first-hand witnesses to a survivor as well. So two body sites, so we're talking a total of, well, six bodies, possibly more.
And what did they do with the live one?
We have numerous accounts of the survivor being taken once again to P3 Building 84, even placed onto a gurney, and from there it was wheeled over to the base hospital. We have numerous accounts of the survivor being at the hospital. Even the private secretary to the hospital administrator, and we have a full chapter in the book describing her experience of how he took her into an examination room. And at first she thought, oh my God, they're children. And then she realized they weren't. And then she saw the one move, and forever traumatized. It was something that even led up to her suicide years later. The family still remains convinced that forever traumatized her. And from Roswell, from all accounts, the survivor then went to Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. We even have a witness who provided a deathbed testimony, the late Black Mac Magruder, who was an ace from World War II. He was a full-bird colonel who was with the War College. And we have the documentation that during his stationing, during his tenure at Wright-Patterson, in April of 1948, he was allowed to see the survivor. And that's the testimony that he provided to four of his sons independently before he passed away in the 1990s. And each one, he described how he was told it was, you know, from the recovery of the crash at Roswell the year before. Beyond that, only rumor, only speculation.
Were they taking good care of the alien?
We've had a couple of reports, and the reason I'm still intrigued by it is because we have two separate versions of something that was kept at the guardhouse back at Roswell for a day or two. And when I talk about the guardhouse, I'm talking about solitary confinement. We're talking about the base jail. And the story comes from one of the MPs who was at the guardhouse, and how this one particular prisoner wouldn't eat, wouldn't respond. And for some reason, his fatigues, his clothes looked way too big on his body. It was hanging off the ends of his arms and draped down at the bottom of his feet. And his cap, he had his cap barely covered his head. And finally, he got his attention. And it looked up, and then he saw the eyes. And again, it's an interesting story. And then we have a similar story from a JAG officer, a military attorney, who was there to pick up a prisoner. And there was the talk of the midget in the guardhouse. So the door is open on that story. So when you asked if they treated it well, there was also talk about they killed it. Those words were flying around that it attempted to escape. And there was a lot of rumor. In fact, there were rumors were rampant even through Roswell at that time, as far as within the city, that the live one was loose and running through the streets. And so you have to keep in mind, Mary, that these people, the country, was still very gun-shy over what had just happened 9 years before, and that was with Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, that radio dramatization.
Yeah.
It was still very vivid in their memories. And it became real. And as a result, it was like, we're not going to be fooled again. And a lot of them...
Yeah.
Made the extra effort to find out, get answers. They weren't going to just let it happen for real and be caught flat-footed.
Yeah, that was kind of an embarrassment for a lot of people in that. So we do know now that there was, you know, based on these witness reports that you were able to get, that there actually was at least one live alien.
Sergeant Eli Benjamin was part of the detail, and Benjamin is still alive in New Mexico. And his wife, who they would marry just a few years thereafter, and she even confirmed that it was the very first thing that he told her after they married.
You know, Don, how much it would change a person's way of thinking about everything. It would change their entire life, you would think. I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, these witnesses that actually seen these bodies and knew for sure that this really happened, and they actually saw these bodies, and or even actually met a live one. Oh my gosh, I mean, you know, I can't even begin to fathom how much that would change a person's life.
Well, and again, for such an unprecedented experience, and you're talking about the very people who just, you know, went through World War II, had experienced, you know, the worst horrors and imagery that any one of us can only imagine, that when we see on a movie screen, you know, thank God, it's just, you know, a dramatization, a depiction.
Right.
It's not the real thing.
Right.
But these people were there.
Yeah.
And his wife describes that to this day, they still sleep in separate rooms because he has, you know, frequent nightmares. He will jolt up during the middle of the night screaming, yelling, and then sobbing because he can't get the face out of his mind. He still sees that face looking up at him from that gurney.
Wow.
And so you're absolutely correct that how do you get beyond that? How do you, you know, finally just put it behind you?
I don't think you can.
But yet, whenever, and there again, we're talking an insult to, you know, the human spirit in the sense that we grasp the situation, we do what we have to, we take charge of the experience, and then we get beyond it. Whether it's 9-1-1, whether it's the Kennedy assassination, whether it's a world war, and even with Roswell. And for whenever I hear people, you know, just apologize that, we're not ready. We're not mature enough. We haven't progressed enough. That's why they're not telling us the truth. And I always hearken back to the very people back in 47 who would live out their lives, would, you know, still raise their families, work their jobs, go to church. There was no mass panic. There was no mass suicide.
No.
I mean, they lived through it, and the difference is they were there.
Yeah.
They saw it all firsthand. And to suggest that, you know, is one of the scoffers again, the late Philip J. Class. Jesse Marcel, he was a UFO buff back in 1940. How in God's name could you be a UFO buff when this was unheard of? There was not so much as a UFO book. Nothing. There was nothing. The point is, the United States Army, where in the field manual do you go, you know, how to retrieve an alien spacecraft? How do you cover it up? How do you contain it? How do you transport it, you know, without drawing a lot of public attention? Again, they had to make this up as they went along. And that was also part of getting the job done, doing what they had to, and then getting beyond it, getting past it. And to me, it's a demonstration that, you know, heaven help us if we've digressed, if we've, you know, gone backwards since then. I mean, we're the generation that has grown up with Star Wars and Star Trek and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I mean, you can't go so much as to a festival. You can't go to State Fair without seeing the inflatable alien, you know, dolls all over.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we are bombarded as far as with that image of that large head and those large black eyes every day.
Yeah.
And it's become so subtle that, you know, I almost wonder if we would see the real thing if we wouldn't just dismiss it as being some Hollywood public, you know, relations scam. You know, somebody just trying to pull a fast one on a dare or a challenge or something.
That reminds me, I have to tell you this story. We had Chocolate Fest here in Burlington 1 year. And all the festivities goes on in the park. So pretty much the downtown area is pretty dead, okay? But everybody at the park's having a good time. So for the fun of it, I had this alien mask.
Mm-hmm.
And I put this alien mask on, and then I had this black robe. So and it looked quite real.
And I'm sure nobody knew who you were.
Well, no, they didn't know who I was. But I just wanted to test it. So I walked all over in the downtown area where it was dead. Okay, where there was a few people walking about, but, you know, nothing, you know, there was not as much as, like, what was going on at the park. But as I walked by people, there wasn't one person that stopped and looked at me or recognized me walking past them. And I would even turn around to look to see if they would look back, you know, because maybe they didn't want to, you know, have like a front confrontation with me, you know. So what they just do is wait until after I walk by, then they turn around and take a quick look, right? But they didn't even do that. Every person, with no exception, every person I ran into in the downtown area, they let me walk right by them without them even looking at me. Just like I was just another person on the street.
So it was a good test, so it demonstrated that it's become such a common...
But as soon as I went up to the park, where they were expecting things like this, then all the kids come running up to me, and the parents were running up and asking if the kids could stand next to me so that they could take a picture. And I mean, they just loved it.
Sure.
But at that point in time, because it was acceptable, the strangeness was acceptable in the park. But outside the park, it was a whole, you know, they didn't know how to do it.
They didn't know
how to respond to it, so they didn't.
So
they ignored
right.
it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of an interesting test. I was quite surprised over that one.
But it truly demonstrates the conditioning.
Yeah.
The awareness that it was nothing that startled young or old.
No.
That it was something that, again, has become part of our vernacular, something that, you know, as a result of what happened in real life, and I did a interview with a Hollywood movie magazine, a radio magazine, just the other day, and we were talking about how Hollywood, you know, just classically copies reality. Hollywood hasn't come up with an original idea, you know, in almost 100 years. And prior to 1947, all the Hollywood depictions of alien spacecraft were rocket ships.
Yeah.
And right after the summer of 1947, they have forever been flying saucers.
Yeah.
Again, based on reality. But it also demonstrates that whether willingly or not, Hollywood has also been part of that conditioning. Whether we're dealing with, and I wax hot and cold with people who suggest that, well, you know, when with Close Encounters and with E.T. and such movies, it's all intended to educate and ready, you know, the people, ready the public for that grandiose announcement that we're going to have full disclosure at any time now. And then I remind them, well, at the same time, they came out with Alien, and then a couple of years later, Aliens, and Predator, and so on. So we're talking about, you know, monsters from outer space all over again. You know, it's almost a return back to the 50s, where the Cold War sparked all types of alien invasion movies. I think part of also keeping people at the ready that watch the skies, because it won't be alien spacecraft, it'll be Russian bombers, so to speak. But again, it demonstrates, you know, time and time again, that people, you know, just don't create such visions, such impressions out of thin air.
No, they don't.
They have to have an origin, an impetus. And as I said, before 47, Hollywood was only going by what they knew, by what they observed. And after 47, everything changed, and not just on the entertainment front, but on all fronts.
But you know, Don, with this book that you wrote, showing, or you know, documenting witnesses to Roswell that not only saw the crash but saw aliens, dead aliens as well as a live one, that just opens up the door to all different things, like such as abductions, contact. It gives credibility to the crop circles, to time travel, to, I mean, you just, your book just opened up a doorway into it all.
Well, and I thank you for even pointing that out, because unlike some of my colleagues who, you know, would have us, you know, stand firm and that Roswell remains supreme, that there's nothing else that compares to it, I point out that Roswell makes everything else possible.
Yeah.
That if Roswell happened, then we have to at least consider the possibility of everything thereafter.
Yeah.
Good friend of mine and colleague, Dr. David Jacobs of Temple University, who has specialized in abduction research for about 20 years now. And I used to argue with Dave, because he would always, you know, point out, you know, at least in his historic background, as far as his, you know, his PhD being in history, that something this unprecedented, you know, would be so difficult to contain, keep secret after all these years. And yet he was such a staunch defender and champion to those who would experience missing time and claim abduction experiences. And I finally sent him a letter and I said, Dave, the problem with you is you accept the egg, but you can't accept the chicken.
Yeah.
And Roswell's the chicken. And he finally had to concede. Because just as in my case, if I accept Roswell, yes, then I have to accept that abduction experiences are certainly possible. It would only make sense that if you have an exploratory intelligence. I mean, after all, they came here for some reason, and I'm sure it wasn't, you know, a long-distance vacation. According to the Air Force Project Blue Book, there were more UFO sightings in New Mexico in 1947 than anywhere else in the country.
Right.
And New Mexico was the hotbed of all military research and activity at that time. You had ongoing atomic research at Los Alamos. You had all the rocket testing of the captured German V-2s over at White Sands. I had mentioned earlier you had the 509th Atomic Bomb Group headquartered at Roswell. I always find it interesting whenever I speak on college campuses, and even the college professors are often, you know, caught unaware of the fact when I ask, where was the first atomic bomb detonated? And invariably, you know, student and teacher alike, well, Japan. And I'll say, no, you're wrong. It happened right here.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was detonated in New Mexico, July of 1945. And, you know, they're flummoxed. They're, you know, amazed. They had no idea. Well, the Soviets were certainly aware of it, and that's, again, a reason there were more Soviet spies in New Mexico than anywhere else at that time. But the point is, whatever intelligence is piloting the UFOs, they too were especially interested in New Mexico. And it would also make perfect sense that another intelligence, upon first arriving, would check out our military potential.
Oh, it would be, yeah.
It would be the very first thing they would check out. And so it, to me, demonstrates some level of logic, of rational thinking and reasoning. And then the next thing beyond that would be, well, let's check out the people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pick up some of the people. We won't hurt them. We'll just examine them. We'll take some samples, and we'll put them back and let them go on their merry ways. And maybe we'll even block it out of their memories so, you know, it's something that won't affect them emotionally after the fact. So there, too, albeit, you know, they're treating us to some degree like tagged animals, I suppose. But nonetheless, there's been a progression, you know, even after the crash at Roswell, leading up to the overflight, the two nights in July of 1952 over the Capitol building, over
Washington,
the White House. And so they demonstrated that they could fly right over our most secure city in the country with impunity. We couldn't stop them. And then beyond that, you had a wave of landings and then occupant sightings in the mid-50s. And then starting in the late 50s and the early 60s, you had the abductions. You had the missing time experiences. So there's been a progression. And then you had the last big wave in the fall of 1973. And the last wave, I say, in the sense that true, there have been episodic experiences, sightings, different countries around the world. But unfortunately, 73 was the last true wave. Up to that point, they were going in five-year cycles from 1947 thereon. And my biggest concern is there's only so many people that you need to pick up, examine, before you realize we're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
We all have the same internal organs and, you know, our nervous systems and our circulation systems and our hearts and lungs and whatever, even our brains, basically, you know, they all function the same. And so my concern remains, albeit they stop by and check us out once in a while, that they've packed up and gone home. And we haven't really had... Think back, Mary, when was the last time that you really saw, you know, big news reports, big newspaper accounts of, you know, sightings? And I mean sightings, plural.
Well, I do know that in the 70s, like you said, the early 70s, I mean, that was nationwide.
Correct.
Because even here in Wisconsin, there was a
Absolutely.
There was a huge
night
UFO
after
problem.
Night,
yeah.
Day after day. Mm-hmm. And the government was becoming hard-pressed as far as, well, now what happens if this continues and if something really big happens? What if there's a mass landing, a mass sighting? And so it, you know, it forces the issue, you know, to the point that next to an actual recovery, you know, it's the closest thing we have to disclosure in that regard. And I applaud the efforts of, you know, the exopolitics people and their efforts for disclosure, but there's nothing like a good series of highly reported sightings to perk and pique public curiosity and public awareness. And, you know, we can talk about what, you know, did happen, what has happened, all we want. And without the physical evidence, we're still, as in the Roswell movie, and the final line
yeah,
that Jesse Marcel is, go ahead, Tell the world, tell them everything. You have no proof.
Yeah. But when you in court, when you get enough witnesses and they're all telling the same story, a person can still be prosecuted.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. And that's
so
where
you really
back.
Don't need physical evidence.
I couldn't agree more. And that's where I come back to Roswell. And that's, again, why I still maintain it as a granddaddy, because we're not just pointing up at the sky. We can point to Washington and say, you have the proof.
Yeah.
You work for us. We demand to see it. Now, whether it was Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton or Bill Richardson or even the late Senator Barry Goldwater or late Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico, they have all made, you know, attempts to release the information. And I think that's the point. That's the thing that we should all be more concerned about. This secret government, this, you know, basement government that is even above the president. And we don't elect these people.
No.
We have no idea who these people are.
No.
And it's scary.
Well, Canada's released information. I mean,
France,
Europe
has.
Yeah. Mexico,
Britain,
South America.
Mexico,
Israel.
Brazil.
Yeah.
And the problem is, and Nick Pope, who I know very well, who was with the Ministry of Defense for a number of years as their chief UFO investigator, and even his agreement that the United States is still calling the shots.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the one thing that would have placed us in the driver's seat? And that would be the actual recovery of the technology, where we have one in our hands.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a matter of time before we crack, you know, that genetic code, so to speak. How do they fly? What will give us, you know, complete, you know, military supremacy, unchallenged, heretofore? And that would be with, you know, alien technology.
I had this one guy stop in a couple weeks ago. He had military intelligence. He'd been in Afghanistan for the last 7 years. And
a long tour.
Yeah. But anyhow, I had asked him straight out, I says, well, you know, about the United States. I asked him, I said, well, do you think the United States will ever release this information? He says, no.
And I would agree.
And I says, why? And he says, because they look at it that it's defense, you know.
I think it's more than that.
Yeah.
That would be part of it. And part of that national security would be, as you've heard me describe in the past, cover up of ignorance. The fact that they still don't have any answers.
Yeah.
And they...
National defense.
And that would be national defense. The other thing would be culpability.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that people have been hurt over this issue. People have been threatened. People have been intimidated, and possibly worse. And people would be responsible. And the government doesn't like to be responsible. The government doesn't like to point fingers at themselves.
Well, wasn't it with Kennedy? They said that the truth would never come out until all the people that were responsible were dead. And I would imagine the same way with Roswell, but the thing is, they just keep repeating mistakes. So,
well,
you know, you can't wait until everybody dies off because they're constantly making the same mistakes.
And sadly, with Roswell, it's a case of where most have been forced,
mm-hmm,
or have elected to take it with them. And I can tell you, Mary, how frustrating. We have missed a number of crucial, key witnesses by a year, by 6 months, by a month, by days. We even called up as the family was returning from the funeral on one particular occasion. And it hits you all the more so in that you realize it's gone forever. Whatever information they possessed, it's forever gone.
And so many of them, they won't even tell their own families.
Correct.
I mean, even after all these years, they take it right with them. I mean, I can't even imagine seeing an alien, dead or alive, or be part of the Roswell experience and never sharing it with anyone.
Well, as you know, in the book, we have an entire chapter, and it's a growing chapter, as far as the deathbed testimonies, the people such as Edwin Easley and Patrick Saunders and Homer Rolette and Miles Wani and others, I mentioned Matt Magruder earlier, who at the time that they felt that they finally could break their oath of silence, break a lifetime of secrecy, and finally confide, finally tell what actually did happen in Roswell. And to a man, they are describing the little people, the ship, the materials not being from this earth, and the bodies being non-human. And so I agree that for those who sadly have chosen that it's too much to handle, it's too much even for my own family to know the truth, whether it's out of protection for loved ones or the fact that we're talking about the greatest generation at World War II, you know, a group of people who knew how to keep secrets. I mean, their handshake was their bond, you know, their sacred oath.
Yeah.
And they were good soldiers to the end.
Yeah. You know, the heck with that, as far as I'm concerned.
I know, yeah, we've come from like, a much more open, much more demanding generation, in that we want to know the truth.
Yeah.
We demand to know the truth.
Yeah.
It was no different than last time I had the occasion to meet with the counterintelligence officer who was with Major Marcel at the time of the recovery of the debris. And here's a man who denied he was even at Roswell. And later, after we documented and convinced him of everything, well, it could have been a flying saucer, but I don't know what it was. And as we were departing, I finally turned back to him. I said, Colonel, you know, I really have to hand it to you. You're a man to be admired. You kept your oath after all these years. You're a true patriot. You know, I really have to applaud you. And he thanked me, and I started to walk, and then I turned back, and I looked him square in the face, and I said, but what gives you the right withholding it from my generation? All of us who weren't even born at that time, and you have decided for all people, what gives you that right? And he kind of mused, and he kind of stroked his chin, and he finally said, I've never thought of it that way before. And then he went, but I'm still not going to tell you anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets frustrating. Now, Don Schmidt is going to be at the Burlington Vortex Conference October 30th, 31st, and November 1st. So we want you guys to get down to Burlington, or up to Burlington, or over to Burlington, wherever you're coming from, and meet with Don. Listen to Don as he speaks on these witnesses to Roswell. He's going to have all of his books there, so you'll be able to get buy his books and talk to Don, ask questions, get your books autographed.
And we've been talking in generalities for the last hour, but it's one of the things I can assure everyone is that we name names. You will see the actual pictures of these people who, as you described earlier, Mary, they could testify in any court of law to any other experience, and people could be, you know, sent to the electric chair. And yet, here they talk about something of this nature, and they're all summarily dismissed. Well, there's power in numbers, and we've to date talked to over 600 people involved with this incident, directly or indirectly, and not a single one is saying it was anything but that very first announcement, that it was an actual flying saucer.
Yeah. For everyone that wants a ticket information or Don's schedule, go to, it's nice and easy, livinginthelightms.com/tickets. Or if, I'll give you something even easier. Go to burlingtonnews.net, and right there you'll just find the flyer that we have, and it's right on that website. Click onto that, and that'll take you right over to burlingtonnews.net/Burlington Vortex Conference. And then once you get there, click on tickets, click on schedule, whatever you want. There's a lot of links there that give you all the information that you're going to need. But we hope that you're going to attend this year's conference. This is going to be our second annual. This will be our second one. Last year's was quite successful, and this year we expected for it to even be more successful, and then we'll just keep carrying on with it every year.
Wouldn't that be grand?
Yeah, well, we're going to do it. I call it the Roswell of the Midwest. I'm hoping everybody will be accepting that.
It's not like
we had a UFO crash, but I mean, the Midwest needs this type of information too. You know, so.
Well, when you consider the
Roswell, you know, when I call it the Roswell of the Midwest, it's actually a compliment to you and Lisa and all those guys that work so hard down there, or Julie that works so hard down there.
Julie
in Roswell.
Schuster, the director of the museum, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
But you put together a high-ranking, high-level conference as far as with just the credibility, the level of the speakers, the researchers, the investigators that you have coming in. So this certainly will stand as the Roswell of the Midwest.
All right.
I applaud you for that.
Yeah, and you can always expect Don to be there too. I always want him to be part of everything I do,
Thank you.
When it comes to all this. Okay.
And if you need to do anything else on the radio before the con, just let me know.
Okay, I'll take you up on that. And folks, you're listening to Don Schmidt, and do you have a website?
Yes.
Where they can go?
www.roswellinvestigator.com.
Oh, okay.
Just Roswell Investigator.
Okay, .com. So go on over there, and if you do buy your book prior to the conference, make sure you bring your book with you.
Be happy to sign it, sure.
Yep, and Don will sign it for you.
Absolutely.
All right, then we'll see you, Don, at the Burlington Vortex Conference.
I certainly look forward to it, Mary.
And hopefully all you listeners, well, not all of you, because I know a bunch of you are not in the United States, but, you know, for those that can make it, we'll see you there.
And I know who you are, and I expect you to be there.
Okay, Don. Talk to you later.
Thanks, Mary.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.